Shalom, this is Gamliel Shmalo. Divrei Yamim 2, chapter 10, retells the story of the break between the northern kingdom and the house of David. We have reached our pinnacle and gone over the hill. From now on, when we consider a model Jewish state, we will kind of look at it through the rearview mirror. Ever since our chapter 10, Jews pray Chadesh Yamenu Kikedem, renew our days, as in the days of old. Divrei Yamim skips over the blemishes of Shlomo, reported in Malachim 1, chapter 11, his loving many foreign women who turned his heart away towards other gods, however you choose to understand that. It skips the adversaries that God stirred up against Shlomo. It skips the prophecy of Achiah HaShiloni to Yeravam ben Nevat that 10 tribes would be taken away from the Davidic king, our chapter's Rechavam, and given instead to him, to Yeravam ben Nevat. We've encountered this theme over and over again in Divrei HaYamim. Caleb has mentioned it, so has Yael and Neria and Rav Joe, that Divrei HaYamim consistently and deliberately overlooks the blemishes of David and his descendants. Where the blemishes are noted, Divrei HaYamim puts them to good use. For example, back in Divrei HaYamim 1, chapter 21, David's census and the plague that followed had a happy ending. The place of the temple was revealed, and David built an altar. Here, Rechavam's mistake in over-asserting his power, leading to the rebellion of the northern tribes, that directs our attention away from Shlomo's earlier mistakes that were, at least according to Sefer Melachim, the original cause. Now, Divrei Yamim has a strong sense of God's hand in history, so the prophecy of Achiah HaShiloni is mentioned briefly in our chapter, but its relationship to Shlomo's mistakes is omitted. Shlomo is an unqualified hero, and Divrei HaYamim preserves his untarnished glory in Jewish memory. Now, some might call this whitewashing. Some might call it airbrushing. And we've heard explanations of why that airbrushed portrait might have been important for the Second Temple generation, which was the immediate audience of Divrei HaYamim. But as we round the corner on Tanakh, and this is chapter 903 after all, I'd like to consider how we might process this carefully edited story, because it seems to me that the deliberately curated portrait painted by Divrei HaYamim is indeed a fitting end to our long journey through Tanakh. I remember having a conversation with one of my teachers about what were then, for me, somewhat troubling subjects regarding biblical chronology, biblical archaeology, biblical historicity, and things like that. Now, while he validated my questions, he also reminded me that in Judaism, as in life, there are big truths and little truths. The big truths are that we are inheritors of a prophetically inspired wisdom. A big truth is that we are a link in a chain of providentially guided history. There is a God, and he or she or it is involved in our lives, both as a nation and as individuals. When we keep those big truths in mind, the little truths, like exactly when did the walls of Jericho fall and how, they become less challenging, even as they remain fascinating and important. So too, as we conclude Tanakh by revisiting its earlier stories, it's important for us to know the little truths, like the human blemishes and political intrigues and the serious sins of even our greatest leaders. And so they have been honestly preserved and reported. But these are little truths, and they shouldn't make us despair, and they shouldn't make us cynical. They shouldn't get in the way of the big truth, that God has chosen Israel and David, God governs history, God has sent us on a holy mission, armed with revolutionary wisdom. Divrei HaYamim should not replace Sefer Melachim, nor was it intended to. What Divrei HaYamim does do is that it refocuses us on the big truths, closing Tanakh with an uplifting pride, inspired to continue on the journey we began so long ago. Now that said, Divrei Yamim does retell the unflattering story of Rehoboam, and perhaps it is for purposes beyond directing our attention away from Shlomo's failings. Perhaps it is teaching us a big truth about the essence of that journey, about the whole thrust of our mission. Remember, 834 chapters ago, Shemot 19, when God invited us to be a kingdom in the first place, he invited us to be a Mamlechet Kohanim, translated by Rabbeinu Bechaya there as a Mamlechet Mishartim, a kingdom of servants. The intention is not that we should be a nation of vassals serving our king. The intention is that even our king, indeed the entire kingdom, should be a servant of God, projecting into the world not the king's power, but projecting into the world God's wisdom. Rabbi Jonathan Sacks wrote that Rehoboam's decision to listen to his young friends and not his father's older advisors was the single most disastrous political decision in Jewish history. That could be. But it seems to me that even the advice of the older advisors missed the mark, because they were providing Rehoboam with a tactic to achieve a goal that was misguided in the first place. They were suggesting how to get the people, b'hayulecha avadim kol hayamim, how to get the people to be Rehoboam's servants for all time. But that's not our mission. The king is supposed to write a Torah scroll and carry the Torah scroll and not have too much money and not have too many wives and not have too much power, that's symbolized by horses, because he shouldn't be cultivating servants. He should be cultivating the attitude of being a servant, together with all his people, on behalf of a mission greater than himself. This is a mission that Moshe knew. It was a mission that David knew. A mission that is inspiring when remembered, but it's easy to forget. And that's a big truth.